I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. President Donald Trump wants a southern border wall that would stretch over 1,000 miles with an estimated price tag from $18 to $40 billion. Congress gave him a little over $1.5 billion, enough for about 75 miles of wall. Whether or not funding a wall is actually approved, security companies are using every ounce of technology to get ahead of the competition. Texas Public Radio's tech reporter Paul Flav attended a recent border security expo in San Antonio and brings us this report.
Last year, Donald Trump's election promise to build a wall had companies working in border security riding a high.
With his emphasis on border security, I think the folks who were in this kind of industry got real excited.
Mike Beltrani is a vice president at Telephonics Corporation.
I think it's still going down that path. It's been a little slower than we expected.
They supply the U.S. Border Patrol and others with these big surveillance trucks equipped with an array of tools that can see as far as 12 kilometers away.
We got video, we've got radar, we've got IR sensors.
A truck like this can augment a border wall or make a wall less necessary. And Beltrani says a lot of programs take longer than you want to close on, but
I think it's going to actually, in the long run, be better off. It just takes a little more time sometimes.
Despite the wild swings in rhetoric around funding border security, organizers of the expo say interest level has remained high, with attendance in excess of 1,000 people from 10 countries.
Well, I think it's obvious because there's a lot more talk about border security, right, than what there has been in years past.
Mark Lucas works for Zero Base Energy. They provide efficient energy systems with large batteries and solar arrays to remote areas lacking power, say like a desert. He says people in his industry are still optimistic. Kevin Gramer with the infrared screening technology company ThruVision agrees. They develop passive sensors with the TSA that show mass transit screeners whether someone's carrying a gun or wearing a suicide vest.
Government procurement is always a challenge. We hope to have that problem in the future.
In this business, he says, sometimes you have to wait to win. Paul Flav, Texas Public Radio News.
For some 2 weeks in January, a Texas agency took to the skies over long stretches of the U.S.-Mexico border. The reason? To drop rabies vaccines in order to vaccinate the region's wildlife. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales reports it's part of an ongoing effort to reduce the spread of the virus in the state.
A pro tip here. If you're heading into the Texas sky to drop a million rabies vaccine packets, which are covered in a pungent animal-attracting fish meal, well, you better take a couple Jolly Ranchers with you.
So, you know, the candies help a little bit.
The smell.
There's about three smells going on here.
This is Captain Stephen Walker with the Texas State Military, one of the agency's airdropping rabies vaccines over Texas. And while he's flying some 500 to 1,000 feet up, he's also dealing with avgas. That's aviation gasoline.
And you get the smell of a dead fish with the avgas. And, I mean, those two together are quite a bit to have to deal with inside the plane and taking off. And while you're actually in the air, you've got 3-4 hours of that in your nostrils the whole time.
It may stink, but state officials say the vaccination program is effective. That putrid stench tormenting Captain Walker in the sky is appetizing to wildlife on the ground. Animals eagerly bite down on the fast food ketchup-sized packets. And once they've digested their tasty treat, the animals are effectively immunized. Altogether, about a million rabies vaccines rained down over 16,000 square miles of the border. But before the planes ever took flight, their path and the airdrops were carefully planned by people like this.
Hi, I'm Dr. Laura Robinson. I'm the Assistant State Public Health Veterinarian with the Texas Department of State Health Services.
Over the course of about 2 weeks, Dr. Robinson traveled through the Texas-Mexico border, making stops in Zapata, Del Rio, and Alpine. Her team traveled in a high-tech mobile command center. And in case you're wondering, the fishy vaccines were in a different trailer.
So each of these boxes has one of these big black sacks in them. Each of these big black sacks has 15 of these little white bags. And inside each of these bags are 300 of the vaccine packets.
Robinson says these annual airdrops can stop rabies in its tracks.
We're maintaining this barrier zone along the border so that we have an immunized population of foxes and coyotes in case there are animals south of the border that are infected with these rabies variants or other rabies variants when they encounter a vaccinated animal, it's less likely to contract rabies.
In turn, those animals are less likely to spread the virus to livestock, pets, and people. So, how did this start? Well, the project dates back about 25 years. In the early 90s, Texas experienced a string of rabies-related deaths in people. And the virus was popping up in places it hadn't been seen before. In 1994, then-Governor Ann Richards declared a rabies state of emergency. Dr. Laura Robinson says within a few years, the oral rabies vaccine program was up and running, targeting wildlife populations along the border and south central Texas.
Wildlife really are the reservoirs that we need to really watch out for. With coyotes, their range extends throughout North America.
That means an infected coyote can travel long distances, spreading the virus along the way. Up next, Robinson and her team will work with the state wildlife department. They'll test wild animals like coyotes, collecting blood samples to determine if they have been immunized. Robinson says, historically, the success rate is pretty high, but it's an endless battle. Come next January, they'll be back, dropping their fish-scented vaccines over Texas. In West Texas, I'm Carlos Morales.
Coming up on Fronteras, a new gallery in San Antonio gives voice to the spirit of Latino artists.
Their work lives on, and this is what art does. This is what art is capable of.
This story, and we'll speak with the Poet Laureate of San Antonio about a poetry exchange when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Jenny Brown is Poet Laureate for the City of San Antonio. As part of her duties as the city's premier promoter of literacy and the written word, is to create a signature initiative. Brown chose to focus on the Alamo City's namesake, St. Anthony. The initiative culminated in an exhibit of art and letters called St. Anthony's Lost and Found on display at the City of San Antonio's Culture Commons Gallery. I had a chance to talk with Brown about the genesis of the project. This exhibit, St. Anthony's Lost and Found, it is sort of based on this idea that St. Anthony is the saint that you pray to when you lose your keys, when you lose your shoe, when you lose that sock. He's the finder of lost objects, pretty much. And so you drew sort of upon that legend to base your exhibit. So tell us a little bit more about how maybe the St. Anthony legend sort of worked itself into this idea for this exhibit.
How did I come to be so fascinated with St. Anthony? I feel like I always have been, in some sense, interested in this notion of what does it mean to lose something? What does it mean to think about what you've lost? And so in my job as Poet Laureate, when I was asked to come up with a signature initiative that would do a series of things. I mean, enhance literacy, engage the community, and because it was happening this year, somehow have something to do with the tricentennial or with San Antonio's history. At first, I was pretty stumped, but then it seemed really obvious that for me, poetry is an art of recollection. Poetry is an art of precision, and that to kind of think about that we are named for the saint of lost things, for the person that we call to, seemed too good to not try to explore more fully. And
there are so many different elements to this exhibit.
Yes, yes.
And so there are a series of postcards when you walk into the gallery. Off to your left, there's kind of a longish corridor where there are some just plain postcards mm-hmm. with the image of mm-hmm. St. Anthony mm-hmm. on there, and there are words written on them. So tell us how this idea of postcards came up and what is written on those postcards.
Okay. The two things that kind of led me to the postcard part of the project, one had to do with that there's a tradition, and I think it dates back to 16th century Spain, that people write SAG, St. Anthony Guide or San Antonio Guia, like on letters, and they still do it. And so I had sort of older people that I had talked to, a friend of mine's grandmother, a friend of mine said, who grew up Catholic, oh yeah, my grandmother still writes SAG. So there is, and this is sort of a fancy poet way of saying it, but there's sort of an epistolary tradition also associated with St. Anthony. Epistolary just means a letter poem. So there's actually a poetic form known as an epistle, which is a poem that is a letter addressed to a particular someone. And so for me, in thinking about how to shape a poetry project around the figure of St. Anthony, I put together this three-part curriculum to use in community centers, schools, libraries. I did a teacher training. I worked with Parks and Rec. And it involved naming, you know, so the significance of the name of our place and of places in people's lives, elegies, which are poems of loss, and then finally, the idea of a letter poem. And so as I thought more about it, I thought, wow, how could I create a more kind of ongoing conversation with these idea of letters? Because letter poems are amazing. You have this idea that someone is sitting writing something addressed to a particular listener. And in some ways, every poem's like that, right? You know, you don't know who your listener is, but you trust that someone out there might come across what you've written and it might help them understand their own lives better. So I thought, okay, how could I take this letter idea and enact it on a larger scale? So all of the people, you know, and there, I think there are 1,500 postcards that have been returned thus far who participated in this educational project in one way or another. Everyone who participated was asked to write a line or two from their poem and send it into the city. So in my mind, it created this larger collaborative poem, that each of these little pieces makes one poem. And this, the city and I had a bit of an argument about this last part, but it just felt really exciting to me to really take it one step further, this exchange part. Because if I'm going to call it a lost and found, right? You know, you go looking for something you lost. But sometimes you find things you didn't even know you were looking for. So there is a literal exchange part. And the instructions above this wall of postcards, I can't exactly remember. It's a read a poem, write a poem,
leave a poem, take a poem.
So the idea, and, you know, who knows, it's a public space, it could go south real fast, but is that the people who will visit will spend some time reading these pieces of poems and find one that speaks to them and that they can literally, quite literally, take it home. But my hope is that they will leave something in its place so that these poems are talking to one another, people are discovering something. Because that's really my experience with poetry so often, is coming upon something I didn't know I needed to hear. I mean, I think that's what made me a poet, that sense that I read something written by someone maybe centuries ago, or someone in another part of the country, or in another language, that said something that helped me understand my own life better. So that's my big hope, that we can all find something in this lost and found.
Well, other than that, you sort of carry on that lost and found tradition into an adjacent gallery that has art in it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So a lot of this art sort of traces San Antonio history, which may or may not be familiar to longtime San Antonians, but there is a whole other piece of the exhibit which is of items that have been lost, or they're gone, and they are called lugares perdidos. They're called forgotten or lost places. There were a couple of those on one side of the gallery that sort of tell those sort of hidden stories that I thought were really striking images. One of them was of the lawyer who was arguing for the right for Mexican-Americans to serve on juries.
Yeah.
And so that was a really striking portrait of that man, where it's really a rather large image of blankness, but at the very bottom, it's a very sort of smallish image of him, but it's very stark, but it's also very profound. Yeah. And the other one that I thought was striking was the one about the, I believe it was the Edgewood High School protest.
And the one you're talking about of Gus Garcia, the lawyer, it's fascinating because you get this just powerful, small figure in the corner, and it's just white behind it. And you know, you can interpret that a whole bunch of different ways, but it's this, it looks like this lone voice, you know, making this argument for these inalienable rights, you know, to have voices. I mean, it really, I was moved at the opening. And the one about the walkout, you know, we forget sort of the segregation history of San Antonio. You know, if people hear it's like a poetry exhibit, they might be a little scared, because poetry's scary. But I do think that you have these intimate conversations with stories that suggest something much larger. And we all know that any individual life, what happens to any one of us happens to all of us. And so to think about our city in that way, and then to also have the opportunity to say something, to add their own reflections or questions or concerns or hopes and imaginations to this larger city poem is really something that I hope people will take advantage of.
That's Poet Laureate of San Antonio, Jenny Brown, talking about her signature initiative, the exhibit St. Anthony's Lost and Found. The immigrant experience is being given a voice at a San Antonio gallery dedicated to the Latino experience, the Centro de Artes. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan takes us there.
It's called Voz, Voice in Spanish, and it's big.
In this exhibition, you have 222 artworks, 166 artists.
Arturo Infante Almeida curated the exhibit from the UTSA Art Collection, much of which was started by former president Ricardo Romo. Over the years, he bought many of these pieces when the artists were still young and struggling.
Here, when you walk into this exhibition, you'll see how these artists have grown. It's incredible what they're doing now.
Photographer and UIW teacher Kathy Vargas has three prints in the collection.
These were done in memory of my life with my parents, who are both deceased now.
The prints show three shoes, which Vargas found in her mother's cedar chest after she had passed. The saved shoes seem to symbolize the parent-child relationship she grew up with.
They're large. They're going to take care of you. You're this child. You're always going to be loved and cherished.
Vargas pointed out several pieces done by artists who have passed on in recent years.
Their work lives on, and this is what art does. This is what art is capable of. If we're very, very lucky, our work will live beyond our time. And if we're even luckier still, there are wonderful collectors and collections that will preserve it.
Around the corner, Claudio Aguillon's photorealistic painting shows a couple in front of a house where they sold antiques.
They are from Mexico, the experience of the immigrant, you know, coming to the United States, you know, owning a home, owning a business, the American dream, and putting their kids through college.
As we spoke, Aguillon then realized he was living his own iteration of the American dream.
I am from Mexico myself. I came here when I was 13 years old. I shine shoes here in the market square when I was 17 years old. So to be within walking distance of where I used to shine shoes and now have my piece in the museum here, I think it's an American dream, you're right.
Voz opened Thursday at Centro de Artes on the east end of Market Square. Jack Morgan for Fronteras in San Antonio.
William Jordan turned Southern Methodist University's Meadows Museum into one of the world's great collections of Spanish art, then went on to build and influence collections elsewhere, from Texas to Spain. Jordan died January 22nd at age 77. KERA contributor Quinn Matthews interviewed and filmed Jordan over the years. He remembers this remarkable authority on art.
El filántropo, mecenas e historiador. The philanthropist, patron, and historian reads the story in Spain's newspaper El País as word spread that Bill Jordan had died. He was an art superstar, a scholar who wrote books, organized exhibitions, and built collections, the first in Dallas in 1967.
When I was very young, just having finished my doctorate at New York University, I was approached about being the director of the Meadows Museum, and I had never heard of it. I came to Dallas to look into it and was amazed that it was not very good. Finally, both the university and Mr. Meadows reached the same conclusion and agreed that they would like to start over with the museum, and they offered me the job, and I took it to essentially begin from scratch, building a collection of Spanish pictures that would live up to the expectations Mr. Meadows had originally when he thought that's what he was doing several years before.
After 14 years, Jordan became deputy director of the Kimball Museum, where we filmed this interview in 2007.
I went from what had been one dream job to another one. And to be able to build an institution, really an institution that had never put on or organized exhibitions of its own up until that point. We began doing that in a big way, and we began an aggressive acquisitions campaign to rebuild and expand the collection. Finally, in 1990, at the age of 50, I decided to follow my father's example, who had retired at the age of 49, and I've been having the third time of my life ever since. I have published my most important books, done my most important exhibitions at institutions like the National Gallery of London and the Museo del Prado and the Patrimonio Nacional in Madrid.
Jordan was a trustee of the Nasher Foundation, the Dallas Museum of Art, and Donald Judd's Chinati Foundation in Marfa. A collector of modern and contemporary art, he nonetheless held some art making in disdain.
Well, there's a lot wrong about art now. I mean, so much of the art today is silly. It's hard to find art, I think, of very great quality today, but it does exist.
In 1988, Bill Jordan, the art detective, purchased a work of rare quality. As he suspected, and years later it was confirmed, it was by Spanish master Diego Velázquez. Jordan donated it to the Prado, a fitting act of generosity from a man who came to Dallas over 50 years ago and built a lasting connection to Spanish art. For KERA News, I'm Quinn Matthews.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced this broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.